For generations, scholars have debated the cause of the fall of Rome in the West. In his monumental work, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, the historian Edward Gibbon laid a large part of the blame on Christianity. And for decades, that view dominated the popular view of the history of the early Middle Ages in Europe. Christianity certainly did play a role in the course of events of that time, and I'm loath to contend with such an eminent and erudite scholar as Mr. Gibbon, but the Roman Empire did not fall in the late 5th century when barbarians overran the West. The empire continued on quite nicely, thank you very much, in the East for another 1,000 years. What we see in Gibbon's is the Western provincialism that was typical of an 18th century European. He largely disregards the Eastern Empire once the West fell. That, despite the fact that the Eastern Empire continued to identify itself as Roman for hundreds of years. And as for Christianity being the most significant cause for the West's fall, it was no less in place in the East as in the West. We can make a case for saying that it was even more ensconced in the Eastern seat of power. After all, while the church and state remained largely separate in the West, in the East they merged. So why didn't the Eastern Empire fall to the no less frequent and concerted attacks by so-called barbarians? The reasons that the West fell while the East continued are numerous and more complex than we have time to deal with here. Besides, our subject is church history. It's not a history of the Roman Empire. For that, you want to listen to Mike Duncan's excellent The History of Rome. Gibbon justifies his position by saying that the Christian faith encouraged chastity and abstinence, resulting in a population decline within the empire. That meant less men for the legions, and those men who did enlist were influenced by a pacifism taught by the church that didn't want to fight. They were all a bunch of 5th century hippies. You know, make love, not war, bro. Gibbon's assumption is that at the same time the barbarians were popping out warriors like rabid attack rabbits, amped to go to war as soon as they could swing a sword. But hold on, Professor Gibbon. Those barbarians, weren't they Christians too? Arian Christians, to be sure, but weren't they, well, of the same general moral stripe as the Romans you claim were getting softened up and ready for the slaughter by a milquetoast brand of religion? So why were the barbarians different? A far better cause to look for on why the barbarians took down the West was the pressure that they faced from other barbarians invading their territory. It was easier and, quite frankly, far more tempting to just vacate territory being invaded by bloodthirsty savages from distant lands and move towards the rich pickings of a decadent and largely now undefended Roman Empire. An empire where the quality of governing officials had so declined that the people would rather be ruled by barbarians than the rapacious, brutal, and corrupt officials sent by Rome, or Milan, or Ravenna, you know, wherever the Western capital now happened to be. So, did Christianity contribute to the fall of the empire in the West? Some of Gibbon's criticisms may have merit, but whatever factors Christianity contribute to the weakening of the empire were more than offset by the benefits the faith brought. As we've seen, had it not been for the church and its very capable bishops, entire regions would have gone without any governance whatsoever. What would have happened to the city of Rome had not Pope Leo convinced Attila and his Huns to turn back? What would have happened had Leo not convinced the Vandals to limit their deprivations to a few days of looting? To be sure, the percentage of genuine believers in the empire was small, but their influence far outstripped their numbers. Christianity altered the values and culture of the empire in both the East and the West. In the mid-5th century, an elder of the church at Marseille named Salvian wrote a book titled The Government of God. He wanted to answer the same question the great Augustine of Hippo had wrestled with, and that was, why did Rome fall? Why would God bring suffering on a Christian people? Now, you'll remember that Augustine's answer to that perplexing problem that everybody was talking about at the time was his book, The City of God, a work that was so influential it became the blueprint of medieval Europe, and so Augustine was called its architect. Salvian said that the suffering of Christians in Gaul at the hands of invaders was not a measure of God's just rule. It was his judgment on the wicked aristocrats and greedy officials who'd mercilessly oppressed the poor. Now, Salvian is unique because until that time, writers tended to put down the common man in favor of the rich and the powerful. After all, who paid scribes to write books in those days? And who bought them? Well, it was the wealthy. Salvian wrote for fellow believers to help make sense of what they saw every day at the hands of barbarian invaders. And he said that God let them in because rich landowners and civil officials were corrupt and abused the common people. While his case is simplistic, it contains a measure of truth that others quietly thought but feared to voice. Contrary to Salvian's picture of the common man and woman, they weren't all innocent, and nor were all officials corrupt. There were exceptions on both sides, lots of them, but a new note had been struck in the old question of why Rome fell. And from that point on, the church began to take an increasingly larger role in being the voice of the common people. It had always put a priority on charity and taking care of the poor, but rarely had it spoken out against the unjust policies of civil officials that deprived people of their rights and property. Now it began to. The city of Rome had been in the habit of evicting non-citizens during famine, but Bishop Ambrose in Milan changed that, making sure that they were provided for. A similar policy was adopted at Edessa in Greece, as well as a 300-bed hospital, all at the urging and with the assistance of believers in the city. Now, this is not to say that in some places the church was part of the problem rather than the solution. In Sicily, for instance, church officials were oppressive in the way that they exacted taxes from the commoners who worked on church lands. When Pope Gregory found out, he moved quickly to correct the problem. Historians have long debated the efficacy of the Christian faith on the morality of the empire. The tendency among advocates of the faith is to attribute too much influence to the church, while critics scoff and say that the church had no impact on morals. The truth, as usual, is somewhere in between. It was the influence of Christianity that brought an end to the gladiatorial combats, but the ever-popular chariot racing, wild animal hunts, and the incredibly immoral theaters, well, they carried on despite regular sermons preached against them. The theater was so bawdy, some emperors banned them. But they carried on in secret, knowing that the next emperor might very well lift that ban. One realm of morality that experienced a major overhaul was in sexual ethics. The modern and popular conception of the late Roman Empire is that it was marked by lax sexual mores. You know, movies and TV miniseries have played up this to boost their ratings. While the imperial palace and the homes of the wealthy were occasional scenes of moral debauchery, the common people were not given over to rampant sexual license. Society then was much like society now. What Christianity did was to elevate marriage and the status of women. And also for the first time, virginity for both men and women was valued as a virtue. While marriage was held as sacred, the idea of staying single and choosing a life of celibacy so that a man or a woman could devote themselves wholly to Christ, well, now that became a major regular part of the Christian community. Pagans considered this odd and another mark that set Christians apart. Sexual intercourse outside of marriage was forbidden, and violators were excluded from the church. When the number of those who'd been excluded grew, it was decided to allow them back into fellowship after they demonstrated public repentance and had done the required penance. As time passed and the idea of celibacy grew, even sex within marriage was edited. It was thought that it should only be engaged in to produce children. Finding pleasure in marital sex was deemed by some church leaders, themselves celibate, as sinful. Sex between a husband and a wife was to be endured to produce children, not enjoyed to build intimacy. Too bad they didn't take the Song of Solomon at face value or apply what the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. The Christian view of marriage had a significant impact on Roman customs. Because it was considered a sacred covenant, divorce was forbidden, except in the case of adultery. By Roman law, a woman was not allowed to marry a man beneath her social rank. If she did, her status was lowered to that of her husband's level. He was never elevated to hers. In the early 3rd century, Pope Callistus not only eased the rule for sexual offenders, he declared as legal the marriage of men and women from any social level. Under the Roman law of paterfamilias, the male head of household had absolute authority over his family and estate to do literally as he pleased. Technically, he had the power to beat and even, well, to execute his wife, children, and servants. And I say technically because while the rule of paterfamilias did grant a father that right, being an abusive brute and killing family members, well, that was frowned on. What paterfamilias did was to denigrate the value of women and children. Christianity fundamentally altered that. Not only were women elevated as co-heirs of Christ with men, children were valued as parents were charged with the stewardship of raising them to the glory of God. The practice of exposing unwanted infants on a hillside, which was a common Roman and Greek custom, was forbidden for Christians, as was abortion. When non-Christians went to some hillside to leave their unwanted offspring, Christians came out from nearby hiding places to rescue them before the wild beasts could take them. They were then raised in Christian homes. As the church grew and more people came to faith in Christ from all occupations and levels of society, the impact of the faith began to be felt across a wider spectrum. Many believers found it difficult to live in a secular world. When a civil magistrate came to faith, how was he to order the torture or execution of someone who before his conversion he wouldn't have thought twice for? Some thought to solve this problem by saying that Christians couldn't serve in public office, meaning those who did serve in that capacity weren't followers of Christ and so were void of the virtues of a believer. And that had to have contributed to the decline in morality that marked the late empire, especially the morality of governmental administrators who became rapacious and brutal tyrants. We think of men like Ambrose and Gregory, who'd been magistrates before they left office to become leaders in the church. The church attracted the best and the brightest who before, well, they would have gone into public office, public service, men like Athanasius and Augustine. There were hundreds who became bishops rather than governors and prefects. It was an ancient form of brain drain that weakened the civil order of the empire. These church leaders were more concerned to build Augustine's city of God than to help shore up the sagging walls of the city of man. And the barbarians, well, they were just waiting outside those walls to tear them down. And that, as much as anything, is what contributed to the fall of the Western Empire. During the 3rd and the 4th centuries, government policies saw a massive shift of people from being producers to consumers. By the dawn of the 5th century, the imbalance was insupportable. The army had doubled in size to deal with a barbarian threat. As in the nature of government bureaucracy, it had mushroomed drastically. But producers, like farmers and manufacturers, had dropped significantly. The cost of doing business rose steeply, consuming profits, and farmland was either threatened by invasion or stolen by elites who knew how to work the system to avoid paying their fair share of taxes. All of that burdened the government at the same time as impoverishing it. And wouldn't you know it, it was right at that time that new barbarian groups decided to have a go at the old girl called Rome. Many commoners of the Western Empire weren't really all that worried about the barbarians. They were ready for change since their Roman overlords had become brutal and rapacious. A change in regime sounded rather good. Out of frustration with the civil authorities in Rome, Pope Gregory negotiated with the Lombards. The Christians submitted to barbarian political rule and then promptly converted those barbarians to the faith. So, Christianity may indeed have contributed in a small way to the fall of the Western Empire, but the question is, was it really worth saving? Was history set back by Rome's demise? If Rome's fall was Christianity's fault, how then did the church become the repository of culture and the treasury of civilization to emerge as one of the dominant institutions in the centuries that followed? The barbarians may have conquered the Western Empire, but the church soon conquered them. the Byzantine Emperor Justinian I's reconquest of Italy, liberating it from its brief stint under barbarian control, was even briefer. Soon after, Justinian's forces regained control of portions of the peninsula and put them back under the empire's dominion, yet another Germanic group invaded and put most of Italy under their jurisdiction. The Lombards were a Scandinavian group who'd emerged as the dominant Germanic tribe. In 568, they conquered Byzantine Italy and formed what is called the Kingdom of Italy, which lasted into the late 8th century when it was brought down by the Franks. Though Lombard nobles continued to rule portions of the peninsula until the 11th century. The Lombards conquered Italy during Gregory the Great's term as Pope. As the Lombards advanced on the city of Rome with not a whit of hope of help from the imperial rulers sitting in Ravenna, Gregory took control in Rome. He secured supplies for the coming siege, though both famine and plague had decimated the land. He bolstered Rome's defenses and commissioned new military leaders to lead the army into the field to meet the Lombards. And once these plans were underway, Gregory then, he opened negotiations with the enemy and finalized a peace with them without the emperor's approval. It's difficult for the modern student of history to understand how the Roman popes managed to wield such political power as they did during the Middle Ages. You know, we tend to layer back onto history the current state of affairs. As Europe is today firmly ensconced in a secularism that's highly antagonistic to the church, it's difficult to see how a pope could have been the single most powerful political force for hundreds of years. While the influence of the pope had grown ever since the days of Leo the Great, it was under Gregory that the pope became a defining role in European history. Though Gregory was in his senior years and increasingly frail, what he accomplished was literally breathtaking. At the same time that he dealt with the Lombards and the daily needs of the city, he administered the church. He oversaw its estates, cared for the needs of his massive flock, provided leaders for the churches of Gaul and Spain, dealt with a constant kerfuffle with the Church of Constantinople, and on top of all of that, he laid plans for the expansion of the faith into new realms. In Europe, Gregory's papacy marks the transition from the ancient world where Imperial Rome ruled to the medieval world ruled by the Roman Catholic Church. Now, the church played a major role in that world. It was the one institution that survived and transmitted Roman culture into the Middle Ages, though altered to fit its unique spiritual emphasis. The Roman church drew its organizational and its administrative structure from the old imperial form. Each city had its own bishop and each region an archbishop. Within each bishop's realm of oversight, called a diocese, there was a staff of assistants, that closely resembled Roman civil administration. Church rules, called canon law, were parallel to Roman civil law. And at first, canon law was defined by church councils that met to decide both practical and doctrinal issues. But eventually, canon law came to include decisions of the pope, a form of imperial edict. Latin became the common tongue, and Roman forms of literature and education spread wherever the church took hold. Whenever a new church was built, its form was that of the old Roman meeting hall, a basilica. As we've seen in a previous episode, though Germanic barbarians conquered the Western Empire, it wasn't long until the faith conquered them. While most of the Germanic tribes were Arian, when they moved south into areas controlled by the Roman Church, they converted to the Nicene Catholic version of the faith. The Lombards were the last of the Germanic tribes to invade Italy. And part of Pope Gregory's strategy in negotiating with them was to convert them, turning them into brothers in Christ. They too began as Arians, but he supported the Lombard queen Theodelinda, who was a Nicene. And it didn't take long before the Lombards were firmly planted in the Catholic faith. Now, Gregory appealed to other Germanic leaders in Western Europe, and they shed their Arianism as well. The Visigoths of Spain became Nicene when Gregory's letter reached their leader, Recared. There was only one Germanic tribe to enter the empire as pagans rather than as Arians, and that was the Franks. They occupied an area near the Rhine River. When their king died in 481, he was succeeded by his 15-year-old son, Clovis. 5 years later, Clovis led his warriors southwest against other Frank tribes. He extended his rule all the way to the Seine River. Throughout this time, he worshipped and gave credit to the ancient Frankish gods. Now, Clovis's victories moved the rulers of neighboring tribes to attempt negotiations. And one of Clovis's envoys returned from a trip to the court of Burgundy, describing the beautiful Clotilda, granddaughter of the Burgundian king. Clovis sent another envoy asking for Clotilda's hand in marriage. The Burgundians were worried what Clovis would do if they declined, and so they consented and the two were wed. Clotilda was a committed follower of Jesus and shared her faith with her husband. Now, he resisted, remaining committed to the old gods for the next 3 years. He thought his distrust in the Christian God was warranted. After all, hadn't the Roman Empire converted to the new faith a century before it fell? Why hadn't God protected them? It was the same question both Augustine and Salvian had dealt with in their writings. Then, a more personal trial struck Clovis. His and Clotilda's firstborn child died only a week after being baptized. While Clotilda's faith was unshaken, Clovis was enraged. Despite his suspicions, Clovis allowed Clotilda to have their second child baptized. And when that son also sickened, Clovis was furious. But the boy recovered at Clotilda's urgent requests of Christ. So with all of this fresh in his mind, Clovis went out to meet what was to that date the Franks' biggest challenge, a fierce Germanic tribe called the Alemanni. The battle took place near the city of Bonn. With the Franks close to defeat, Clovis called upon the old gods. No help came. So in desperation, Clovis cried out to the Christian God, saying something along the lines of, "Jesus, if you're really the Son of God, as my wife says, grant me victory and I will believe in you." Now, certainly a dubious request, and God doesn't make bargains, but the Alemanni experienced a dramatic reversal. The Franks were victorious. That day in 496, turns out to be a dramatic turning point for the history of Europe. Clovis was good to his promise. He invited Bishop Remigius of Reims to instruct him in the faith, and he was baptized on Christmas Day. Remigius continued to instruct Clovis in the faith, but the ever-ready-to-fight king was unable to grasp the call to forgive. When Remigius told the story of how Jesus was arrested, tortured, and executed, Clovis shouted, "If I had been there, I would have avenged him." A few thousand of his warriors soon followed their king in baptism. And one anecdotal story that comes from this time was that there were so many troops wanting to be baptized that they had to do a mass baptism at a river. A dozen would enter the water, and then a priest would, you know, stand on the shore and bless them as they would lower themselves under the surface. But as they did so, they would lift their right hands above their heads so they never went under the water. And when the priest asked, "What are you doing?" the warriors explained that they didn't want to baptize their sword hand. They wanted to continue to make war and didn't want to submit the hand that held a weapon to the rule of Christ. Now, to be clear, that tale, while attributed to Clovis's troops, it's also assigned to other periods of church history, especially the Crusaders. And whether it's true or not is in dispute. But what the story illustrates is an important feature of medieval society, that the adoption of Christianity was in essence a royal policy. The ruler's religion decided the religion of his subjects, and queens did much to bring about the conversion of their husbands. Clovis was one of the first of a line of French kings known as the Merovingians. His conversion paved the way for an important alliance between the papacy and the Franks, but it took decades before that alliance altered the way that the Franks treated the church. Throughout most of the 6th and 7th centuries, the Merovingian court appointed their own bishops to the churches of Gaul. At the end of the 6th century, Pope Gregory began to work with them to alter this, but it wasn't until the 8th century that Rome was able to regain control over church appointments. After Gregory, the West entered a difficult period, as we've chronicled in episode 32, Losing Ground. The Western Church suffered abuse from both Lombard and Byzantine rulers. In Gaul, the Merovingians treated the church as a political tool, and the quality of church leaders declined dramatically as church offices were just sold to the highest bidder. Until this period, the clergy were men of great learning and intellectual skill. A list of the great thinkers of the first through sixth centuries is dominated by monks and priests. But the political corruption that followed hard on the heels of the demise of the Western Empire, it led to a decline in the intellectual prowess of the clergy. That decline was slow at first, but escalated as the decades passed. That's what happens when church offices are filled by political appointments paying favors rather than gifted and called servants. Bishop Gregory of Tours lived in the late 6th century and is the main source of information about the Merovingians. He describes the sorry state European society had fallen to. It was a period when women stood almost alone in maintaining what was left of morality and virtue. Monasteries and convents became lonely islands of true religion and a sea of moral debauchery and spiritual corruption that included church leaders. The state of affairs continued all the way to the 8th century when revival took root at the instigation of Celtic missionaries from Ireland. Other factors that led to this revival were a renewed papacy and a new Frank dynasty. Celtic missionaries had been at work in Europe since the last half of the 6th century. Most notable among these was Columba. He was born to a noble family in Donegal, Ireland. After schooling, he was ordained a priest and planted churches and monasteries in Ireland. But then, in 563, Columba left his homeland. Why he left is a mystery. But it seems that it was a kind of self-imposed exile. Columba had helped spark a civil war between his clan and the king's clans. As penance, he left, setting himself to go wherever the wind blew. He was accompanied by a dozen friends. They landed on the tiny island of Iona on the west coast of Scotland, where, against all expectations, they established a thriving monastery. Many an observer would assume that due to the harsh conditions, Columba and his companions would have died within a year. On the contrary, while life was tough, they thrived, and the monastery became the focal point for a new movement of God that would reach out to thousands of miles. Missionaries were soon being sent to found monasteries along the coast of Scotland, back in Ireland, and along the northern coast of Europe from Gaul all the way to Scandinavia. Taking a page from St. Patrick's playbook, Columba was warlike in the way that he went about spreading the faith. At his preaching, King Brude of the Picts was converted. Columba's spiritually aggressive posture was necessary because he was dealing with a determined and overt enemy in the form of the Druids, who only understood force. A weak and timid brand of faith would only provoke them to acts of hideous grotesquery. Columba's blend of mystic spirituality coupled to a tough-minded application of the faith in a political and social context, all shaped by a commitment to scholarship and a love of nature, marked Columba as that rare individual who was the right man at the right time doing the right thing for the right reason. He's the prototypical example of Celtic Christianity. Columba was the mold that Celtic Christian missionaries were cut from as they sailed across the sea to land in Gaul, carrying the sparks of revival that united to bring Europe out of the great spiritual recession.